So if you guys, hopefully you came prepared with questions. If not, we could just sort of babble about legal issues up here. But, I mean, this is for you, right? If you have questions, non-specific legal questions. We are lawyers, but we are not your lawyers. So if you ask about a specific situation, and Justin goes into this in detail, but yeah, there could be specific facts that we don't know about, and we would find out in a much longer consultation with you. So
you're here for the legal Q&A?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So don't take our information as legal advice. Simply general legal information about the games industry.
Like I said, I mean, two simple questions to start off. A, do you have a business card? And B, how about your credentials? Like, you know, history and stuff like that.
Okay. Yes, I have business cards. And two, I'm Zachary Strubeck. I'm a game lawyer. I work with clients in, you know, video games, tabletop games, mobile apps, websites, all the, you know, that kind of thing. I represent clients like Stollmeyer Games, if you know them. My firm represents Sterling Games. We've worked with Cryptozoic, some other tabletop developers. I've represented developers who are licensing their games to publishers and vice versa. I don't know. Just basically any – my hands are in all aspects of game development.
Gotcha. My name is Justin Jacobson, and I've been practicing for about 20 years. And most of that I do civil litigation, contract work, debt collection. But over the past 7 or so years, I've started working more and more with game companies. Presently, I'm general counsel for Evil Hat Productions. They do the Fate RPG, Dresden Files, and stuff like that. And then a few other, and I do a lot of work for freelancers, reviewing contracts, or if they don't get paid by the publishers, I help them get paid.
I realize.
And we'll give business cards out at the end.
Okay. So,
yeah. I'm not very good at talking about myself. I don't need to get better at that, work on my elevator pitch. Okay, questions?
Yes. All right.
Let's start it off.
Working with an artist, would you guys be able to maybe describe a few of the more common rights agreements you might see when hiring an artist? And I was also wondering if a rights agreement is necessary when working with a graphic designer. Say the graphic designer comes up with a symbol that represents something in your game. Do they hold rights? Do you need a rights agreement to say, okay, that symbol needs to be my symbol for this game? You can't then go and use that symbol in another game. Or is that different from rights that you would get from, like, an artist who's supplying, you know, character art or you know, something like that?
Well, I think any original creative expression is protected by copyright as soon as it's fixed in a tangible medium of expression.
So
right?
Does that even count for, like, fonts?
Fonts are weird because they're inherently functional, which is functional things are not protected by copyright. So I think the ornamental parts of fonts, maybe parts of fonts, can be copyright protected, but fonts are very weird. Anyways.
Yeah,
specific flourishes or something to make it more artistic. Might be.
Well, and the thing with so like icons is an interesting example because sometimes like a star, for example, is not protectable because it's a common image. But if you have some sort of unique icon in your game, that might be something you could protect. Probably most likely with trademark, but I would guess. I guess it depends. I don't know.
It depends. I mean, it has to reach a certain bar to be counted as something that's protectable, right, under trademark. So
I want to step back to sort of the first level of your question, though, is do you need a contract? So a couple things. One, you never need a contract unless you end up in court, really. I mean, that's what they're there for. And the secondary thing is as a communication tool so everyone is on the same page. If you write it down, it's like anything else. If you write it down, everybody's got a clearer understanding than if you're trading emails or just chatting or whatever. Everybody knows what's going on in that arrangement if you have a contract. But legally speaking, the only function of it is in court to sue somebody if they've breached it. If you and your best friend work something out and he makes a logo for you and you use it and he just goes on his merry way, then you know whether you have a contract or not is irrelevant. So
I'll disagree with you there on one point.
If you want to have ownership or authorship of that work that they've created as a work made for hire, the copyright statute does require a written work made for hire clause that's signed in your agreement.
But again, that's all legal. That's correct. If I wasn't clear, my point is if you pretend that you have ownership rights and he pretends that you have ownership rights,
okay,
and no one does anything about it, it's moot.
Well, I guess more what I wanted to know was, say, I know if you want exclusive rights to that artwork, you're going to pay a premium.
Probably.
But do you often, it seems more common to say, hey, I would like rights to use this in a video game setting or a board game setting. I will let you use this as a portfolio.
There's two fundamental ways to structure those types of agreements. Either they're going to hold on to the rights and let you use them, or you're going to get the rights and they get to use them. And the level of that is who owns which of the rights and who gets to use them and in what way is what the contract does, just generally. So
yeah, so a lot of the specific terms are, you know, well, if I give you the rights, like I said, work made for hire, or if they're your employee, right, all that stuff is automatically, owned by you as the employer. Or if you license it from them, you know, you have to negotiate terms like how long do they get the license? Do you get to license it for? What's the scope? Like you say, just tabletop games or maybe tabletop games, video games on your website. You know, you can have a big scope or a small scope. It could be exclusive. It could be non-exclusive. You could, if you choose, license it back to them if you own it, right? You don't have to. You know, you don't have to give them the right to put it in their portfolio. But I mean, would that be a fair use?
Well, it depends. Yeah, I mean, it depends how they use it. Probably.
Yeah.
As long as they're just demonstrating as like their quality of their work.
And if it's not under a confidentiality agreement, right. So if you know, in contracts that I wrote, right, basically there's confidential information clause where everything you work on is confidential until you, as the developer or the publisher, make it public, right? So once you make it public, they can put it on their website or something like that. They have a license to do that, but it's subject to the confidentiality agreement.
Those types of things are really important to hammer. I was kind of sort of being very generic in my comment about not needing a contract, but those are precisely the sorts of things that are important to lay out in a contract when you're working with an artist.
Yeah.
Because you might say, oh, I'm making this board game. I'd like to use your art for my board game, and he owns the rights, and you get to use them to make your board game. And your board game becomes a big hit, and someone comes along and says they want to make an app of your board game. Guess what? You don't have the rights for that art to use in that app. And now you've got to go back to the artist and presumably pay extra.
Yeah, he's
to
in a
get
much
the
better
rights to that.
Negotiating position.
Saying, oh, you want to use it for an app now? Yeah. That's, you know,
yeah.
Sweet, sweet money.
Yeah, get them when they're cheap. And before you know it's successful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any, could you just make some general comments about somebody who develops at least to the prototype stage game and doesn't want this to be their life's work? You know, it's a hobby, fun thing. Wants to work with a regular company. What are some of the good ideas, the bad ideas?
Well, I mean, the fact is, if you're talking about, so you're developing, let's say, a board game, and you go to, well, let's, you know, Hasbro or you know, ILO or Asmodee or whatever, you're not going to be in a great bargaining position. And they've done hundreds of these agreements and worked with hundreds of designers. They're going to present something to you. And you might be able to, on the margin, say, oh, can we tweak this here or there? But generally speaking, you're not going to be negotiating a lot with them over all this. And you can sort of go with the flow, keeping in mind that, obviously, they have a reputation they need to maintain in the industry. As long as they have a good reputation, which is something you can find out, you're most likely not going to be walking into any sort of viper's nest if you're working with a known publisher who's been around for a while, you know. And that's the kind of thing, you might get the agreement, you might have an attorney try and look at it. That's what I do for a lot of my clients. I just read them over and say, hey, this provision doesn't make any sense, you know, to ask them to change this one thing or whatever.
Right. Yeah, when I look over those agreements, I'll make a bunch of changes and maybe 30% of them get through, maybe not even that much. You know, I put my perfect world version back to their lawyers, and their lawyers say, no, we can't do that. We can't do that. You know, you get the best you can do. You don't want to, like they say, over lawyer it and kill the deal, right? I'd rather you got the game published and got some money out of it than you know, the whole deal blows up because I want to change every little thing in your contract.
But if you're not, it's not your job, you just have a game and it's, you know, this one neat idea and you want to see it published and out in the world, 99 times out of 100, if you're working with a known publisher who has a good reputation, you can just go with the flow. They'll have an agreement. You'll probably be fine signing their agreement without doing anything.
Right.
You know, I can't guarantee that, obviously. You never know, but it's just sort of common sense, if you will.
Was that your question, or were you wondering about
just talk.
General things, like if you're doing it as a hobby rather than...
Well, you know, if you develop a game, you don't want to go into the publishing business.
Okay. So you want to license it to someone. Okay, so I guess
is it usually a license?
That's exactly what it is. You're licensing your intellectual property, which is the game you've created, to them, you know, and they may change everything or whatever, but in exchange for some sort of royalty that you're going to get from them. That's a license.
Yeah. When one does that, is it usually a one-time payment or royalties, or does it
usually depend? Royalties.
Yeah. And sometimes you might get an advance.
Yeah, you might get an advance, then you earn out the advance, and then you'll get royalties down the road.
Yeah.
A lot of them have provisions where if they make an app or sell T-shirts or things like that, you'll get some other, and it might be some different percentage usually.
Yeah. When you when you
we'll get to everybody.
when you license a game with a publisher, to the publisher, do you still retain is it like you can't do anything with it anymore, and they can change whatever they want and do with it what they will?
It depends.
You technically have ownership. If it's a license, then you retain ownership and you let them use it. That's what the license is. But generally, I mean, I've seen them usually there. It's basically perpetual, right? If they don't like it, they can give it back to you, but they'll say, okay, for 5 years we get this, and then we can renew it if we choose to for successive 1 year terms or whatever, or 5 year terms or whatever. And they're the ones that are in control, and that's one of the things I try to push back on, but usually
You might see another provision in there where it'll terminate if sales fall below a certain amount over a quarter or a year or something like that, and then the rights revert back. But, yeah, it depends. I mean, by definition, if you're licensing, you own it, and you're giving someone else the right to use it. You can also do it, just sell it to them, and then you would, you know, you can do that. It's not as common in the tabletop industry, but you can do that.
Right, but, I mean, effectively, you don't have ownership of it anymore if you're giving them perpetual right to use it, and if it's exclusive, right? You may be able to sell that IP as a video game, and they only take – it's probably rare because they're probably going to want – broad rights to do whatever they want with it, but if they just license it as a tabletop game, exclusive in that industry, you know, maybe you could make a TV show out of it or something like that.
So those agreements, like one of the, you know, you might have one or two little paragraphs up front where who's the parties are and that sort of stuff. And then the big meat and potatoes is the license provision, and it's you're going to see perpetual, worldwide, and exclusive 9 times out of 10, and those are the three things, which means. Forever, everywhere, and
hereafter invented, and throughout the universe, and all kinds of wild terms. Yeah. It depends
how old school they are. Right?
I don't see that as much anymore. But I worked in TV distribution, and it was nonsense. It's full of nonsense.
And can they still like change whatever they want?
Though? A lot of them will have provisions that give them the right to do that. For example, I mean, Hasbro is they have a very broad provision in their agreement that says they can do whatever they want with it.
And they're going to own all the changes that they've made. So any new things that they come up with, they own them. So you can't, let's say the contract terminates after 5 years, you can't take it in the state it was when they released it. You only get whatever the seed that you gave them was, that's what you own. So you have to be aware of that.
And then kind of to go along with that as far as licensing that, how does like copyright and trademarks kind of tie into that? And then they kind of go further with that. Could you kind of explain maybe even just the process of getting a copyright?
Okay, that's a lot of things rolled up into one. So let's step back real quickly and talk about the difference between copyright and trademark, right? You want to do this? Or you want me to do it?
Yeah. Well, why don't you take copyright and I'll take trademark? How about that? Right. I like talking about trademark.
That's fine. So there's really four flavors of intellectual property. When we talk about intellectual property, there's trade secrets, which doesn't matter for these sorts of things, generally speaking, and rarely. More so in the video game side of things. And then patents, which rarely, if ever, comes into play on the tabletop side of things also. That's where you are protecting a process or, you know, a design or whatever. It's got to be something non-obvious, functional, whatever.
I think the one definition I looked up was new idea.
Yeah, novel, basically. Non-obvious. Those are the two criteria. Yeah.
I heard you couldn't patent a game.
You can't patent a game. You can patent a specific process. And so the famous one is the tapping mechanism in Magic the Gathering, where you the process of turning a card sideways to show that its effect has been used, they filed a patent for that.
Yeah, so they did a patent for, like, the entire gameplay flow and things like that.
Right.
You know? So
yeah, there are things. The reason why it doesn't come up very much is just practical. They're very expensive, and they don't last all that long.
Yeah.
So for board, you know, it's and the, given the numbers you're talking about dollars wise and tabletop, it's just not worth it usually.
Right. Few games, I mean, it, like they last 20 years, but few games are going to be evergreen for 20 years that make it worth spending that $10,000 or $15,000 up front on the patent.
And that, so interesting example, I'm just sidetracked for a story here. One of my clients is Rob Davio, who worked for Hasbro. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him, he did Risk Legacy. So, this idea of this legacy mechanic where you're changing the game as you play, writing on cards and the board and tearing stuff up or whatever. And he had recommended to them that they patent it, and they said, eh, we don't think that's really patentable. And then he left, and that was because they hadn't patented it. And I think they probably could have, but they chose not to in any case. After he left Hasbro, he went and did Pandemic Legacy and then Seafall in these games. So if they had had a patent, then he would not have been able to do that.
Would the patent have applied to the combination of all those ingredients into a single thing, or would the patent have applied to each one of those elements?
Well, I mean, that's there's the rub. It depends on how they would have filed it and what would have ultimately been accepted. Right. You know, there's no way to know.
Gotcha. Okay.
They're usually very specific.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
each
why
one of those
special lawyers.
Could have been unique enough to require its own patent. It wouldn't have been like,
Yeah, I mean, it depends.
Yeah.
Anyway, so going back now, I'm supposed to talk about copyright, right?
Sure.
Okay. So copyright is the protection over a specific expression in a fixed medium. Okay? If I skip over anything, let me know.
Original creative expression.
Original creative expression.
Term.
In a fixed medium. And so typically you're talking about things like books and movies and things like that. And so one of the interesting things about tabletop games is that there's not a lot of copyright protection in practical copyright protection in a game, in a board game. Because, and this, we can talk about this more in a minute, there was a recent decision that came out, the Bang decision. I don't know if anyone heard about this, but have you guys heard of the Bang the card game? And there's a dice game too, but specifically Bang the card game where you're playing like Desperado and Sheriff and Marshall and all that, and then there's you're playing cards and you're shooting people and riding horses and doing all this stuff. Well, some game in China, right, China stripped all the flavor out of it and put in a samurai theme. Exact same gameplay, identical. But they just, different art, different characters. And the court said, and then so the publisher of Bang, I always get the names from Impossible, TV, Yochi.
Da Vinci?
No, it's like, it's. It's some Italian name, but it's not Da Vinci.
Okay.
It's a very hard to pronounce name. That's why I remember it. But they sued, and they ended up losing. The court said that basically you couldn't protect, or you didn't have a copyright on gameplay. And this is something we've sort of known for a while, but they did a good job of writing an opinion and explaining and going over that. So really, if you think about it, on a tabletop, the things that are protected by copyright would be the actual written rules to the extent that they're, you know, like a rule book you could copyright. The problem there is I can go in and rewrite the rules in my own words and just do, you know, do the same effect, the same gameplay, the same mechanics using my own words, and I haven't violated your copyright. This is actually a big thing that comes up in cookbooks because recipes aren't really protectable. So as long as the you know, like a particular recipe is not something you can protect with copyright, so you go in and you just, you know, change the wording of it to using your own words, and you know, you're good to go. You can steal a whole cookbook,
basically.
And then the other thing is the artwork, obviously. So if you've got art on your cards or art on your board or things like that, or sculptures for your miniatures, those are all protectable. So I couldn't go in and use your art for your board game and use it in my board game. That would be an obvious violation.
Right.
So again, like really, the artistic styling of your game is really the only thing that could truly be copyrighted.
Yeah, the interesting thing, be careful when you say artistic styling, because there's this weird sort of amorphous border between copyright and trademark. So if you get, like I said, something like a picture of a star is not copyrightable, right? Or a picture of an apple. Not, you can't copyright it. Just the image of an apple. Like a specific image you could, let me be clear. If I take a photo of an apple and I, you know, put a frame on it and call it a day, someone can't go and just start making it. But that's not the image. I can't, if I draw my own apple, you can't say, wait a minute, I have a picture of an apple in my game. That's copyright violation. Apples are. But you could get into the issue of trademark, which is why Apple's apple is protectable as their trademark, right? And so you might get into some stuff that constitutes what's called trade dress.
Yeah.
So if you have a particular graphical style that might not be protectable in copyright, because I might be doing something using a similar thing but sort of putting it in a different way. I'm not copying the images, but I'm mimicking the graphical design. Then we might get into trademark. And that seems like a good segue to get into Zach talking about
trademark. I'm going
to
talk about trademark first.
That's what G.I. Joe did with the scar, correct?
Huh?
They trademarked the scar for their G.I. Joe back in '60.
I am not familiar with that. Sounds interesting, though.
Interesting.
Because G.I. Joe in the '60s with a larger doll.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had one of those.
They were coming out, and other companies were producing G.I. Joe type figures, mm-hmm. and the trademark, they couldn't trademark a person. So every G.I. Joe has a scar on their face, and they could trademark the scar.
Hmm. All right. Sounds interesting. Yeah.
I saw that on Instagram.
So trademark is a source identifier, basically, at its heart, right? So when you walk into a store and you see Coca-Cola on the side of a bottle, you know that when you open that up, it's going to be Coca-Cola from the Coca-Cola bottling company, right? It's not going to be Justin's Coke that he made in his back bathtub or something like that and, you know, put the logo on, right? So it's twofold. It's for the consumer so that when you walk into a store, you know the source of the product that you're buying, and it protects a company from other people coming in and sort of taking their business goodwill and things like that, right, and confusing consumers. So your name of your game is going to be trademarked. Your logo, right, the design of your logo is going to be trademarked, right, or trademarkable. And so once you start using those marks in commerce, you get those rights, right, automatically. However, you can't really do anything. Same with copyright. As soon as you fix your creative expression in a medium, you get rights, technically. But they're sort of, they're out there in the ether. You can't really do anything with them. You can't sue anyone over it. You need to register them first. So that's why we always talk about registering trademarks, because that gives you the right to sue someone in federal court and to, you know, stop the importation of goods from, you know, counterfeit goods and some other rights that most likely don't come up. But the suing people and the, you know, sending to Apple to take down a game off of the App Store, right, and says, I'm trademark number such and such, or, you know, it's copyright registration such and such, it gives a little more weight to your claim.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not quite right.
Uh-oh.
Only in the sense that you can sue under common law.
Oh, okay.
But he's right. I mean, as a practical matter.
Can you sue in federal court or only in state court?
Maybe only in state court. Okay, yeah, I think you're right about that, actually.
But you'll lose.
I never sue in federal court.
He never loses.
I never sue in federal court anyway. Okay. I hate federal
court.
So
they kind of give a metaphor.
I never sue anyway.
They give kind of a metaphor for it all that. It's like you have, you know, an apple sitting in the field and you want to protect it, so you put a barbed wire around it. But let's say you want to protect it even more, you put guard dogs. That's kind of like the layers of the trademarking on that is the extra.
It's a bit like a Venn diagram, actually.
Yeah.
So they all protect different things. But they sort of overlap, but not really. And they all have different times, so copyright is... You know,
are you talking about the protection afforded by copyright and trademark, or the registration and the common law?
The registration.
Okay, so that's a little different, yeah. So, again, as soon as you make something, like let's say you write a book, right, and you put it up on the internet or whatever, you have a copyright, and you can slap a little the C symbol, and you can put the year that you published it, and you have that copyright. Same with the trademark. If you make a logo and you'll see the TM, that stands for trademark, or sometimes SM. We don't use it as much anymore, that's service mark. That means they're claiming a trademark, but they haven't registered it. Once you register it, you get that R with the circle. You can only use that after you register. And that means it's registered, which does afford you these extra rights. It's easier to prove. You get attorney's fees or costs or something. I forget what it is once you register.
With copyright, you definitely, I think you get attorney's fees within the statutory period.
So, like, the... Just one last... Yeah, sure. No. Actually, How would you then go about actually registering? Like, would you basically just come to you guys? Yeah,
come to a lawyer and we'll do it for you. Okay. I mean, you could technically do it yourself. I wouldn't. I've seen self-done copyrights and trademarks that are just awful, just full of mistakes, you know, and we have to go in and spend just as much money correcting the mistakes as we would have, possibly more, because you may have to actually refile the entire thing, which, you know, just costs
you. And sometimes it might be too late. If you've crafted it in a way that's not effective, you might not have done yourself a service with what you're trying to protect. So.
Right.
Patent you can't do on your... It's, forget it. Don't even try.
We can't
you
do it.
You could theoretically do it for yourself or something, but it's difficult.
Yeah. You already went. Maybe we'll go with him.
I think they both went.
Oh,
okay. Whatever.
You just said file for copyright. I thought that was already, once you establish it, you produced it, you put your little seal in there, you've got a date on it. I thought that was actually the registering it. You actually didn't have to do more.
You don't have to. Okay, let's be clear. You don't have to. And so for a lot of things, I think registration of copyright is much less common than registration of trademark. I don't know if that's your experience. But
I think it's more important.
Maybe it's just that there's more people publishing things that don't bother.
I'll talk about percentage, maybe. Yeah, I mean, most people don't bother.
But to clarify, that's not registration. Registration is an actual filing with the USPTO, or a Patent and Trademark Office. And there's a process and a filing fee and... You know, it's a formal process to actually register.
I have a friend of the family that...
What's that?
What about the copyright?
For both.
There actually is a formal process for art and for text. And
you can do it together. You pick which one is predominant, and you pick... That's how you register it. But you can do it in one registration.
Is that a lot of money?
No. It's $55 filing fee plus whatever you pay the lawyer to do it.
The one thing let's disabuse right now, I mean, you might have heard of this thing where you mail yourself the letter, certified letter with the signature.
The poor man's copyright.
Yeah, have you heard? Don't bother with that.
Don't bother. It gives you no rights.
It doesn't do anything.
Yeah, it does nothing.
It makes you look weird.
Yeah.
You said copyright or trademark the name of your game. I thought
trademark.
Names of books.
Okay. So that's an interesting point. The name of one book... So I released Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, right? Philosopher's Stone, whatever is original. I do not have a trademark on the title of that book, right? But I released Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. That's the second one. Now I have a brand, right? Because now I have two things, right? Movies, a single movie does not a copyright make. Movie title, I mean. But with games are weird. I don't know why, but they allow games to be trademarked with a single work, right? I don't know what, honestly. It's because you play it multiple times or something?
Yeah.
I'll have to look into that. Copyright, you can't copyright a title. A title, a short phrase, something like that, you know, it doesn't give rise to the level of protection that copyright gives you. Copyright will protect you for, 120 years or something past the... Oh, or 70
now,
years past
I mean.
The death of the author, or it's 120 years or...
And they keep making
something.
It longer.
Yeah, keep making it longer. You get a lot of protection for copyright, so they don't give it out willy-nilly. That's why there's a lot of defenses against it and limitations on it. And one of those is that a phrase or a short one sentence is not copyrightable. I think...
Same thing like the image of the apple or the star wouldn't be copyrightable, but if it's unique enough and you're using it in a particular way, you could trademark it. Same
thing. Stuff is really complicated.
Yeah.
It's amazingingly complicated. Yeah. But
I feel like we missed it. We just started down the question. What was it?
So a game title, you copyright that or trademark?
You trademark. Yeah.
Okay. And should you get that before you start working with a publisher or...
If you're going to, if your goal, and I nodded my head for the video, I nodded it no. If you're going to be working with a publisher, you really don't need to do any of this stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
They'll do all of it.
Yeah.
And this idea of trying to protect yourself as you're letting publishers see it, because you're worried they're going to steal your idea, is a myth. It just doesn't happen. There's a couple famous examples, and, you know, the people.
Somebody also sold something to Brooklyn
Bridge.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
I feel like there was something I was going to say. Oh, well.
Okay. Anyone else?
Oh, I know what I was going to talk about real quickly. Trademark. So there's word marks and I was... what's the other kind? The picture, basically.
Design marks.
Design mark. Thank you. I was reading that. So something like, for example, my law firm is Lawcraft. And but I also have a logo. And so if I have a wordmark, which we registered the wordmark Lockwrap, which means that no one else can use that word no matter how they display it, right? So there's some guy in San Francisco wants to start a podcast called Lockcraft. I can send him a little letter, which I did. That happened. But if it's just a design mark, then you're protecting the logo. And then the question is, so they could use the same word. So if I'm making a game called Seafall, right? If I have a design mark, then someone can go and they can make a game called Seafall. Their logo looks entirely different. They might be able to use that. If it's just a design mark as opposed to a word mark. So there's a discrepancy there that you need to be aware of also.
Right, or if someone calls it, you know, I don't know, McDonald's. Well, okay, that's a bad example. I'm trying to think of a title. But it looks exactly like the Seafall logo. Then you would be infringing on the design mark.
Right.
So it's protecting different things. And, of course, there's two separate fees, two separate trademark registrations. You know, they get you coming and going. But what can I say?
Yes.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about contracts with dealing with a publisher.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a little bit about protecting the work that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any pitfalls that you may be aware of or common mistakes that are made more in the design process?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm creating a game, you know, I need to make sure that I, you know, maybe do copyright searches, or I need to make sure that I have kind of protected myself
mm-hmm.
from any legal issues. Even prior to having the box ready to go to sell something.
Well, there's an interesting thing there. Is a lot of the contracts you'll sign with publishers, you will be warranting that you're not stealing someone else's IP. So design is not usually, again, we talked about this, you can't really protect a design unless, you know, it's difficult to do. And so that's not something you need to worry about. But and then on the other side, as far as like the name and the logo and stuff, they're going to handle all of that. So it's the burden's on them. Like if you say, oh, here's my prototype for Seafall, not knowing that they're, and they just go and publish it, that's on them. I mean, they need to, when they go to make the product,
make sure it's in their name. I mean, they're releasing it under their company. It's very difficult to search copyright to see if someone has done what you're doing already.
Right.
That's why, I mean, I think a practical way to do it is to just be open with your design, and you know, you're sort of crowdsourcing the fact that, hey, this is my game, and then someone's going to say, whoa, this looks exactly like such and such. You know, they'll probably be complaining about it, right? A game that they love. And then you say, well, now I need to step back. I mean, I don't know any practical way to say, hey, here's all my artwork. I mean, you could reverse image search it on Google or something, and maybe see. I honestly don't know. There's no easy way to know every artwork. I mean, even established music artists, you know, they there are songs that they just happen to infringe on, and you know, it just happens. You can have independent creation, and that's okay as long as you didn't have access to the other person. So infringement on copyright requires two things: it's access to the infringed material and substantial similarity. So it has to be very close to it. But if you've created it independently and it looks exactly like this other guy's thing that he's been hoarding in his basement and he's never actually published or anything, and he comes and sues you, well, you say that there was no access to that. So you didn't infringe on their copy.
And this idea, so again, there's some things you can't protect in games. So if you say, my game, we stack dice, and the color of the dice or the order of the color of dice is what drives, that's the mechanic of the game. It sounds like a bad game, but still. And they go and release it, and some guy says, wait a minute, I have another game that does that. You've infringed. There's nothing to infringe on. Like, that's not, unless he somehow got a patent on that. It's not protectable. This idea of stacking colored dice is not something that's protectable.
It's actually a scam, like three-card multi-dice stacking. I've seen a scam artist do it.
So even other legal issues, not necessarily copyrights.
Okay.
For example, when I come up with a game, what age range do I put on? How do I know? Like, I mean,
again, if you're the designer, that's not, you don't need to worry about it. The publishers have a lot to worry about on that side.
Right, but if I'm not looking at selling to someone, if I'm looking to self-publish.
Publisher. That's a big difference, So publishers have a lot of different hats to wear. And safety testing and labeling, and that's a whole big thing. And we mentioned this on another thing. There's the Consumer Product Safety Council, CPSC.gov probably, if I had to guess.
Yeah.
They have a ton of information on their website about the testing that's required based on what type of product it is. And
what age
there are lawyers who specialize in that.
Mm-hmm.
Insurance is something you might want to consider, liability insurance, things like that.
Because I was looking at getting into the manufacturing end, because I'm going to be purchasing a large laser cutter and doing stuff for other companies along with. I was wanting to get more information on the trademark if someone comes to me to run some, let's say, trophies with a certain trademark of, say, Magic the Gathering, how would I be liable if I was hired by another company to, say, make these trophies for a con?
Personally, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You may have something in your contract with them that they indemnify you, but then you have to, A, you're going to get sued. Then B, you have to go after them, right, to pay for your lawsuit. And if they
most likely they'd be suing both. That depends who the deep pocket is. You know, that's the fortunate truth of things. They'd probably sue both and collect from the easiest two, one of you two to collect from.
I mean, it's a problem you don't want to have, basically, right? If you know it's if you know it's something that's infringing, I would just not do it.
Yeah, let's get the guy in the back.
Just going back to the patent issue, even though they are pretty rare in the industry, can you go for a design patent or a utility patent?
I have no idea.
I was going to say, it depends. It depends
depends on
what it is that you're patenting.
Is it design patent like the ornamental?
Yeah,
stuff?
Like the Coke bottle.
Okay,
is a design patent.
Yeah, this bottle.
You probably not that one. That's boring.
What?
The Coke bottle is a famous example of that. But utility is so like Amazon's One Click. I think they patented that, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
That would be a utility. And I guess it depends. I don't know. I mean, I'm curious. I'm trying to think if I can remember what Magic did with tapping, and I don't. But my guess would be utility.
Yeah, probably. If my understanding is correct, that's
yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of why it wouldn't be, but yeah, I think that's probably right.
I'm not planning on doing this, but if you looked at Monopoly and designed a property trading game that had the same, you know, same number of spaces, same kind of stuff, if I understand what you said, that is not an infringement.
Well, the devil's in the details.
Right.
So a couple things. There's definitely a way to make a Monopoly clone. In fact, people have done it. But then the other side of the coin, too, is that that is, you know, you're going after the biggest beast in the land, and they will, even if there's even a hint of something they could sue you over, they would do it just to be aggressive, because that's obviously a very huge property for them. They're going to be as aggressive protecting that as they could possibly be. But and if you're asking, is there a way to make a Monopoly clone that's kosher? Yeah, probably. I'm sure.
Anything that was patentable in the original Monopoly, I mean, it was 1919, I think it was invented or something. So, I mean, that's long gone, but there's trademarks, there's copyright.
The name of the city or the property.
The name of the cities are facts. You can't really protect those, but the order layout of the cities on the board, that's copyrightable.
The color
scheme. Yeah, there's so much that is protectable in a Monopoly board that, you know, it's not.
I think they just, I don't know if it was a lawsuit or they got a cease and desist or something. Anyone watch Mr. Robot?
Yeah.
They had the Monopoly guy, Moneybags mask.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I think they got a cease and desist.
Well, that seems like it.
Anyway. Yes.
Question about the liability. You mentioned that. So, you know, some of us want to sort of self-publish. We potentially put our sort of thing together there. So, what are we really looking at here? Is it personal liability? Is it, how would you go about, what do you recommend that sort of thing? Because, I mean, let's say that some game has been, you know, they can't patent, from what I understand as you're saying, is going around the board after you roll dice and then something happens. I mean, that simple mechanic has been used an awful lot.
Yeah.
But you've got other people that, I'm just trying to get a sense of, what do we see in terms of lawsuits? Are these personal lawsuits because my kid ate the token? Is it intellectual? Like, your game looks a lot like mine? Or is it sort of,
But first things first, I mean, the first thing I would say is form a corporation because you want to shield yourself from personal liability. That is a no-brainer. You know, you find out that something horrible has happened and they sue your company for $10 million. Well, that company probably didn't have $10 million to worry about. And you go out of business and you go do something else, you know. You're like, woo, that was a close one. If you don't have that, guess what? You know, you get your wages garnished and, you know, you can lose your personal property. And it depends on the state, but that's what I do for a living.
Yeah.
You know? So form a corporation.
Or an LLC. I mean, a corporation or LLC, it's...
Type of corporation and where you do it and how you do it, I'll leave that up to you. But definitely form a corporation. Then, like I said, you can get insurance, too. And then as far as what types of things you see, I've seen all of that.
It all happened. That's the problem with going into business. You know, there are a million things that could go wrong.
People do it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, people, but you know, there's always a risk inherent.
You need to be careful. You need to act professionally. I mean, if you're running a business, you need to run it like a business and make sure you are getting good advice and doing the things you need to do.
Grab stuff off Google Images and throw it in your game. And, you know, I mean,
be smart about it. What if your business isn't making money, where you donate all that you've got there? Does that offer any protection at all? No. If basically you're not looking to make a profit.
In terms of, so this idea of like, I'm going to violate your copyright, but I'm not making a profit on it, so it's okay. That's a common myth. I just figured I'd mention that. I know that may not be explicitly what we're talking about. It doesn't protect you. I mean, it might make it so that you don't have assets they can go after when they sue you.
Right.
But
they can still sue you.
It doesn't shield you from liability in any way. I mean, you either violate the copyright or you don't. Yeah.
Back on the safety item.
Sure.
If you're working with a publisher and you license your game to them, is that all on them?
The people that are putting it into the market, which would be the publisher, the ones who have to do all that stuff.
Okay. And a lot of times I've seen it in the contracts where they'll outline the specific insurance claim limits and things that they'll have. I've seen that.
And do you know of any website or something that has things like, well, if you want to make a game that's really safe, the pieces should be this big or...
The consumer,
that CPSC website.
They'll tell you.
CPSC.
Yeah, Consumer Product Safety Commission.
Maybe it's .gov.
Commission, I think. I can't remember if it's commission or council. Commission, I think. What's that?
I was going to point something out about that. That I used to think that if it's like for adults only or for whatever, you can still have them come down with a hammer on you, like if you look at the Buckyballs, those little magnetic toys that were clearly marked for adults only. Well, you know, kids got into them, kids died, and they pulled it, even though it said adults only, do not.
Right.
And so there, I thought that if you market adults only, put a big X on it, no, they can still come down and you can't sell it.
That's to read about that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's a good point. I mean, I'm guessing, obviously, it's some, like, you know, a Ford Pinto's for adults only, too, but if the gas tank keeps exploding, they're going to pull it from the market, you know. I guess the kids are essentially a secondary market. They're, in other words, instead of the Ford Pinto exploding for the driver, if only the passengers were getting hurt, they'd still pull it.
Well, let me clarify. Did the government come down on them, or were they hit with product liability lawsuits?
Probably both, I'm sure.
These are the Buckyballs. Those are the magnetic toys.
Yeah, no, I think they...
When the children eat them, they run into serious problems.
Sure.
They eat more than one of them.
Yeah.
And they basically forced it from the market.
Yeah.
Exactly. What tool they use, I'm not sure.
Okay.
But as far as I know, that the manufacturer cannot sell them.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't want to guess, but I think they basically banned them, essentially.
Okay.
in some de facto way, if not de jure ways. So there's things, if you have choking hazard, which is pieces smaller than a particular, like a tube, you have to put, like, you know, that 0 to 3 with the big red X on it, and... So a lot of people we talk to will get around this by saying their game's for 13 and up. Then they don't need to do all the safety testing in terms of, like, toxicity of the paint or in the pieces and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fairly common. I think we talked about Europe's a little bit more strict about that. So if you're going to sell it elsewhere, you probably will have to do more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just kind of in general, so you said that if you label your game as for 13 and up, you can kind of avoid... some of those things. Are there any other kind of little tweaks like that that can make publishing just a little bit easier?
I don't know. Make your product safe.
I'm trying to think. No, it's an interesting question.
You mean specifically safety related or just in general?
Anything in general that might come to mind? Because, I mean, that could save a lot of time and money. And
sure.
Just by saying, hey, if you're under 13, go play my game, please.
I'm not thinking of anything off the top of my head that's similar to that. That's sort of one of the common secrets of the trade.
Yeah. So really, the age range is more about the safety more than what this game is really designed.
Originally it's supposed to be, you know, who it's
actually for,
targeted for in terms of gameplay and stuff. But a lot of publishers started saying 13 and up. Even if, you know, an 11-year-old could play the game, but if they say 13 and up, they don't need to worry about
it.
Yeah, exactly.
Any more questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
You mentioned Hasbro a couple times.
Do companies like that even talk to, like, Joe off the street?
Yeah. Okay. In fact, yes. Joe off the street, less so than someone who's obviously a known designer. Yeah. But, in fact, Hasbro's past couple of years has run a contest with an open design contest. It's sort of an interesting one, too, because you participate in this contest, and then they pick finalists who run at least this is the way they did in the past, run an Indiegogo campaign, and then whoever gets the most money out of that Indiegogo campaign, they end up publishing. I forget the one that won. It was some pretty lame game, actually. It was like something with food. I don't remember. Whatever.
Yeah, and I've seen a bunch of agreements with first-time designers getting published by, you know, companies that put their things in Target and all that. It's possible. You just have to be able to get access to them, right? And,
yeah. In fact, Gen Con has a good thing. They have this designer speed dating thing where you can go and meet with, like, 20 publishers in 6-minute pitches all at once.
You missed it. It happened yesterday, I think.
I actually had signed up for it and then missed the window. I didn't realize you were supposed to get a sell sheet out.
So they're not. Yesterday was pretty much the only time you could do that.
That's over. Yeah.
And I think you would have had to apply earlier.
Give them your...
So that they would have been extra planning ahead of just, hey...
Next year, start planning now.
I think they run it on... at some other cons, too. If you Google... I forget who runs it. It's one of the publishers, or... If you Google designer speed dating, you'll find it. Hopefully nothing bad will come up if you Google that.
It may find some interesting.
It's a good idea for a site, though.
Yes.
Can you give a range of how much the royalty would be for someone working with a game company?
Sure.
I mean, is it like 1% or...
It's going to be
more than 1%.
Yeah, it's going to be a single digit, but probably more than 1% and less than 10%.
Yeah.
You know. Depending on who you
are. Four or six, I've seen some of those. That's pretty common.
Yeah.
I've had some rare ones where it's been in double digits.
I've seen, they brought art. They already had the art done, all that. You know,
or if it's a name designer, who their name on the box is going to sell it. If you can get, you know, I'm sure Eric Lang's getting more than 4%. You know.
So to help you out, the more you bring to the table, the more they're kind of willing to.
Yeah.
Or the more, yeah, I mean, if you
have. And if you have a fan base, if through something else, like the Exploding Kittens guy, I don't know what, you know, the oatmeal, you know, I don't know, I'm sure he's got better, you know, in fact, he didn't design the game, obviously. But if you had a following like that and said, here, I've got a game, you know, if he came to someone and said, would you like to publish my game, for sure, it's probably a joint venture at that point, you know. Where it's the art that's really selling. So, you latecomers in the back.
Yeah,
are you here for legal stuff?
There?
You got legal questions? Are you here for something else?
Okay.
You don't have any legal questions, though? Yes.
I have just a quick question about, like, the USPTO and stuff.
All right.
Sure. I've been kind of toying around with different, like, ideas, and I go on there and I do a search.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes something comes up and sometimes something does. But if it comes up dead... What does that mean? Because, like, on the USPTO office, it's like, oh, if it's dead, it means that they don't have any right to, like, the registered trademark.
Sure.
They have, like, common law rights to it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I generally do a threefold search where I search the USPTO, and I'll cut off the end of the word, things like that, to try to find, you know, variations on it. Because, it, you know, if it's a phonetic equivalent, which means it sounds the same, that's a potential infringement. You know, if it's a plural versus a singular,
if they combine it.
Yeah, all that stuff. And, you know, so you have to be careful about all that. I check, there's an EU trademark database. Check that, too. And, you know, I go pretty deep on Google to see if anyone's using it where they would have common law rights.
Right. Yeah.
You can't ever know everything, but you can do a pretty diligent search.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, your requirement is to do the diligent search. But yeah, so they might have let their registered trademark die, but they could still be selling the product. Then they've got common law trademark rights.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yes.
Can you give some general ranges for a simple lawyer's fees for simple copyrights and trademarks?
I usually don't charge. So.
Okay, yeah, I do charge.
Your business.
No.
I charge, so for trademarks, I charge a flat fee, in the mid, you know, it's less than $1,000 and more than $100. It's about $600, right? Mm-hmm. Plus the filing fee, which is $225 to $275, you know, around there if we file electronically. Mm-hmm. If something big comes up during the time and I need to spend a couple hours researching and writing a response to them, like if they reject a trademark, then I would charge you hourly at my hourly rate. Copyright is a much simpler. It's not a 12-month process like a trademark can be. So, you know, there's a filing fee and then maybe a couple $100 to go along with that, too.
And to clarify, the reason why I don't charge is because I'm on retainer with most of my clients. And okay. So I just do all the work for the retainer.
I work mainly on the flat fee basis. So you tell me what you want. I tell you, okay, this is what it'll cost. And you pay me up front and I do it. That's
how it works. I think we have to wrap up. So any last quick questions? And then we have business cards to hand out if anybody wants. All
right, yeah. Yes. Yeah, if you got tickets, throw them in the stack.